documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Biggie Davis is here. Nice to have you with us as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today's the 29th of July, 2017, and here we are again. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning, Darren.
Caught you off guard there, didn't I? You didn't expect me to throw it.
Well, I keep my microphone off so that I, you know, don't make noises.
So, what's been going on this morning? Been a busy week.
Yeah, very busy week. I've been trying to write a paper on what is Agenda 21, including
the history. That's a loaded subject.
Yeah, well, you know, it would be just so easy to say it's about the environment and it's about control, but if you really, it really helps to understand what led up to the production of the report, Agenda 21. It's probably an act of futility for me to do this because people don't read, but I don't know. I just have this obsessive compulsive need to document things.
That's good though, because I mean, even if the people don't read it today, someday in the future, and this is what I've always kind of believed about our program and about everything else that we've written. And Nancy Levant and I have talked about this a lot back when she was doing the show and we were working together. Hopefully, at some point in the future, some future generation will read something or see something or hear something that some of us have done and be inspired by it and use it to cast off the chains at some point in the future. Even if, because, I mean, let's face it, in many ways, this present generation, and I don't want to be dark here, because I do believe there's a way to turn it around. I do believe that there is strength in numbers, but it is going to take a lot of people to set this thing back. It seems like the other side always takes two steps forward and one step back. And when they get any opposition, they don't hesitate to say, oh, okay, well, we'll step back from it. And then when nobody's looking and everybody goes back to their lives, then they're advancing again.
You're absolutely right. It's like a never.
They're very patient. They've been very patient. And
yes, they've been working on this for over 100 years to build this international world order.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that's going on in our country is a function of building that international order. And that's why the American people who believe in American sovereignty and the nation state are considered the enemy of the government, because it's not really our government at this point. It is a component piece of the international order.
Yeah. Yeah, so my belief has always been that the people could turn it around, but if the people fail to turn it around right away, at some point in the future, assuming that the general population has the ability to form a coherent thought, and there is that problem because with all the technocratic stuff in place, and we know Google wants to, I mean, there's a lot of mind control things going on right now, but Google is wanting to even go so far as to put a chip in the brain, and that's not a new idea. That's something that, you know, what was it, Sergey Brin or one of the other founders of Google came out with years ago. I mean, I remember back when I was working for the CBS affiliate, so it had to be sometime before 2008. I'm thinking it was shortly after 9/11 when I discovered. I'm guessing probably around 2006 is when I discovered the whole transhumanist movement, and I was very intrigued by it. I didn't realize it was a part of the larger technocracy at the time, but anyway, this has been an idea that's been building for many, many years.
Sure. Yeah, I've even read articles about using chips to, you know, alter body functions, you know, in some way. And of course, the first idea that they tried to float was the idea of the chip for security, you know, so that you could just, rather than having an ID badge, you could just have a chip in your skin and, you know, that's your security. Mm-hmm. You just wave it over a scanner and it lets you in. And that's really how they will begin the introduction of this. But the gradual putting in of these external devices into the body is mechanization of the body.
Yeah.
And if you think about it in the same way as software controlling physical mechanical processes, it's really kind of the same thing, you know, putting chips in our body to control bodily functions.
Yeah. I wasn't going to start with this, but since we're on the subject, let's go ahead and do this. There was a, you know, of course, we've been covering here on the broadcast, the push toward a cashless society has been moving forward. There was a story this week about a company in Wisconsin that was pushing microchips for their employees. I first saw this story on CNBC's Nightly Business Report. The company's name is Three Square, which sounds pretty Masonic to me. Anyway, I thought the story was pretty important.
But it is something, it seems, out of a science fiction movie, or for those of you like me who would remember it, The Twilight Zone. Employees of a vending machine company in Wisconsin are being offered microchip implants that let them access the building, log into their computers, even pay for things.
So what do you think about being microchipped by your employer? We asked, and many of you were skeptical.
If you can microchip somebody to go into a factory, you could also microchip them if they're at a political meeting.
I think if it's convenient, it's easier for people to keep track of stuff. I say go for it, but I also don't know the negative effects of it.
It's a surgical procedure.
Obviously.
And why would you want to walk around with something underneath your skin?
Now, you hear these people the way they are. I mean, did you catch that, what that woman, you know, I don't think there's a problem with it.
Why would you want to walk around with something underneath your skin? No, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea.
I've always used an ID card. I don't see what's so hard about that. Yeah. Swipe, you're in.
Yeah, I would be totally opposed to that because you don't know, when that starts, you just don't know where it ends, right?
If they're saying that they're not going to use it to track them and that's in writing, and there's a contract that specifies that, then I don't see the harm.
I don't see the harm. What's the problem?
What a silly girl.
Well, you know, who are these morons that on the street? Oh yeah, that's a fine idea.
Yeah. You know what? I participated in a group, a discussion group. They actually paid me $60, I think it was, to participate. And what they wanted to know was our feelings about something. Actually, what it was is colonoscopies.
Okay.
And there were only two of us out of a group of about, I don't know, six or seven that said, absolutely not. I would never have one unless I have a problem. But the other people, and you could hear how the group leader was kind of leading them, and they said, oh yeah, I'd go get one every year.
The group leader was leading them?
Well, kind of, yeah. You know.
This almost sounds like a Delphi technique.
It was okay. A Delphi technique.
Huh.
And, you know, but I was an immovable object.
You're one of those ones that have to be marginalized.
Yes.
Well,
I don't believe in going to get preventative things, I guess.
Well, the best...
If I have a problem, I see a doctor. If I don't, I don't, because I don't like seeing doctors.
Well, I try to... You're better off not seeing doctors if you can possibly avoid it. Now, there are some situations, I think, that life-threatening, you have no choice. You have to be stabilized. But, yeah, doctors kill a lot of people. But anyway, they brought on an ethics professor on this program, and I actually like the way they... CNBC dealt with it. This is again the Nightly Business Report, and they're a little less troublesome as far as liberal biases than a lot of the other media. Anyway, they brought on an ethics professor to talk more about the ramifications of this.
So what are the pros and cons of a business, your employer maybe, implanting microchips into you? Joseph Holt is an ethics professor in the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. He joins us now to discuss what are the ethical or bigger, broader questions here about microchipping an employee? Presumably it's voluntary. You don't have to do it.
Yeah, I think the emphasis is that presumably it's voluntary. One of the questions this raises for me, Tyler, is can this be like one of the United Way campaigns where donations are voluntary, but your boss is evaluated based on the level of participation he or she achieves so that there is pressure on you to do it even if you don't want to? So are these employees being pressured either by peers, you know, criticized for being Luddites, or are they being pressured by management to go ahead and do it?
Yeah. One of my questions is why is it necessary? I mean, we have smartphones.
Right.
There are so many other ways that we can achieve payment for something. I mean, the CEO of this company says it's in 20 countries already and it's working well. But do we really need it if we have the devices that we have now that seem to be working well?
Yeah, so I think that's a tremendously important ethical issue.
Notice cash is completely left out of the whole equation.
I mean, if the company can achieve the same objectives, providing convenience for their employees without implanting an electronic device in their bodies, wouldn't that be a better way to go? I mean, I drove to the studio today using this fob from my Toyota, and that enabled me to open the car doors and start the engine without having to fumble for a key,
mm-hmm.
But if the only way to get keyless entry was by implanting a chip in my hand, then I'd say give me the old-fashioned key.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we use here an ID card that gets us into the building that we use to log on to printers or copy machines that we use at the cafeteria. I would think there might also be a medical liability issue here. What if something goes wrong? The injection site becomes infected. I don't know the medicine of this. I wouldn't want the doggone thing traveling around my body and ending up passing it like a kidney stone. I mean, it's just crazy, man. Ouch.
Yeah, and those are crucial unanswered questions. I mean, you know, is it ethical to move ahead with the wider spread use of the technology when the health effects of it are unknown? You know, just because it's the coolest, latest thing.
Yeah. I guess the other issue is what's being done with the information that's linked to this chip?
Right.
Because you're buying things, so you know, the information is out there.
Right. So, you know, is the information handed to somebody else? If I always get Twinkies from the snack machine and I start seeing pop-up. Right. I start seeing pop-up ads on my computer from Twinkies.
Okay.
Am I getting a little nervous? You know, there are some companies that charge a premium for health insurance for obese employees, give a discount for the fit ones. What if CNBC implanted the chips?
We have to leave it there, Joe. The chips are down, and we're down on the chips. Joe Holt at the University of Notre Dame.
And that's it
good
for
to
us.
Be with you.
Have
night,
a good
everybody.
Night.
I'm actually glad to see the mainstream media actually staring at some of this stuff with a critical eye.
It's kind of surprising that they're not promoting it.
but that particular show has more of a conservative audience, too. And so I think that that's probably why is... You know, part of the first rule of broadcasting is knowing your audience.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm glad they did bring on an ethical ethicist.
Easy for you to say.
That's hard to say.
All right, so since we're on the subject of technology, and man, is there a lot going on in the geopolitical realm. We got North Korea firing another missile yesterday, so we'll get to some of that as time progresses. But I did want to revisit a story that we did here back, what was it, a few weeks ago. It wasn't that long ago. We played a story that was sent to us by Ron in Missouri, who is, he's involved in the vending business, and he had attended a business meeting where they unveiled the future of the vending business. The new system was called Vicky. Now, you'll recall that Vicky was not was a new vending machine that lets a customer authenticate with a smartphone or some biometric identifier, you know, your microchip. They don't have that in there yet, but I'm sure, you know, that they have the capability of building it in. But you authenticate to the thing in some way, and then it opens up and you can take whatever you want and go. The item is automatically charged to your account, which is linked to whatever means of authentication that you used. And at the time that we played the story, you remember I said that I think this is the future of all retail. Well, I didn't realize it would unfold this fast. Now, Amazon, having just purchased Whole Foods, is rolling out its brand new system that replaces or that puts into place this process.
4 years ago, we started to wonder, what would shopping look like if you could walk into a store, grab what you want, and just go? What if we could weave the most advanced machine learning, computer vision, and AI into the very fabric of a store so you never have to wait in line? No lines, no checkouts, no registers. Welcome to Amazon Go. Use the Amazon Go app to enter. Then put away your phone and start shopping. It's really that simple. Take whatever you like. Anything you pick up is automatically added to your virtual cart. If you change your mind about that cupcake, just put it back. Our technology will update your virtual cart automatically. So, how does it work? We used computer vision, deep learning algorithms, and sensor fusion, much like you'd find in self-driving cars. We call it Just Walk Out technology. Once you've got everything you want, you can just go. When you leave, our Just Walk Out technology adds up your virtual cart and charges your Amazon account. Your receipt is sent straight to the app, and you can keep going. Amazon Go. No lines, no checkout. No, seriously.
What do you think of that?
I would never use that. I like the I do use the self checkout at the grocery stores, but have you ever had that experience where you bought something and it had the electronic tag, and the clerk forgot to scan it to deactivate the tag?
Yeah, you walk out,
and the alarms go off.
Exactly.
I mean, that is so embarrassing. It's so I like the positive scan, you know, where it's scanned. I know it's scanned. I have the receipt.
It's kind of like this. Stop! Stop! Thief! Thief! Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, because you don't get a receipt for what you bought. And, I know. I
usually
like
get
that.
A receipt, but it doesn't, you know, everybody looks. Cause attention to yourself, and here's a person going through your bags. Yeah, you're immediately a suspect.
Well, I mean, de facto, if you just eat, I don't care what Amazon says about their app. If you pick up an item and you walk out of the store with it and you don't have a receipt, they could claim that you've shoplifted it because you don't have a receipt.
Yeah, I'm
and
always
long,
that way.
How
about
long would it take to get the receipt from Amazon? I guess, you know, it probably cost you half an hour to wait while the store, you know, looks up Amazon. I don't know. I just don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it either. Another thing I don't like is this data collection that's going on everywhere with all of our devices. Devices that used to be stuff that you could pretty much count on not collecting data. You know, now increasingly, especially I think with smart grid and then the smart meters, devices are going to automatically be communicating and phoning home without your knowledge. One of the things that was a scandal this week. Do you have something to say before I?
No, go ahead and finish that, okay. And then I'll say.
Yeah, keep your thoughts in place, but we're being sucked further down into the rat hole of the internet of crap. Smart vacuum cleaners now are a thing. Now there's just one big problem. They're collecting the data on everything you do. There's this one that's called Roomba, which runs around your house. Well, maybe not your house, but other people's houses. And, you know, it sounds cool. Hey, you know, I can spend $1,000 for a vacuum cleaner. And, yeah, it's expensive, but it's going to be sucking up my house. And your daughter's hair, too, if she happens to be laying in the floor. I saw a story where some girl was laying in the floor, and she didn't realize she fell asleep there, and the vacuum cleaner came and was eating her hair. So you do have that problem as well. But setting all that aside, the data collection, it was just revealed now that this thing is being, it's mapping the house, which I guess you could say, you know, the floor plan. And I guess you could say that this is a valuable thing for it to have so that it can be more efficient and not miss spots, you know, and
sure,
stuff.
Sure, a self-learning device.
Yeah, machine learning. But the problem is that they're sharing these floor plans with other companies now.
Hi, guys. This is Valentina Palladino for Ars Technica, and we're here with the launch of iRobot's new...
Now, this is Ars Technica, and they're doing a review on this thing.
Roomba 980 robot vacuum. This one's more advanced because it's the first connected one, so you'll be able to download a mobile app and schedule different cleanings whenever you want. It has some more sensors in it, so it'll be even better at picking up all that dirt that might be around your house. So the Roomba 980 runs on a program called iAdapt 2.0. And the main difference between that and the original iAdapt 1.0 is that there are two different sensors in this. One is a vision localization sensor. So what that helps the Roomba do is map the room around it. So it'll be able to actually build a map of your home by sensing things that are in its way and also remembering its shape and memorizing where it is in your home. So eventually, this Roomba could have an entire map of your living room or wherever you choose to keep it once it goes through a couple of cleanings in your house. The second one is a tracking sensor. So it knows how much it's moving around your house, and that also helps with the map building process. So one of the cool new features of the Roomba 980 is something called Carpet Boost. And what that does is that allows the Roomba to know what surface that it's on at the time that it's cleaning. So if you have hardwood in your home, if you have carpet, if you have a mix of the both, or you have tile, whatever that may be, the Roomba is going to know when it's on those certain surfaces, and it can adjust its cleaning for those surfaces. So for carpet, you're going to get 2 times the cleaning power and 10 times the air power. So that's going to help it pick up all of that dirt and all that debris from the carpet.
Didn't catch that she mentioned it in there, but another thing that I heard or read someplace is that this thing actually is now coming equipped with a low-resolution camera.
Oh, gosh.
So that it can see things that are in its way. So, I mean, everything has a purported purpose, and then it has a secondary and more secretive purpose. You know, if it's got a camera in it, how long is it going to be before that low-resolution camera is upgraded to a high-resolution camera? And if they're already sharing, in fact, here it is, The Guardian, Roomba makers may share maps of users' homes with Google, Amazon, or Apple. iRobot, which is the parent company that makes this thing, the chief executive of that company says they could share or sell maps of robot vacuum cleaners, robot vacuum users' homes to U.S. tech firms as part of a smart home and profit push. So that what they've done, and I'm going to give them the benefit of a doubt here, they began mapping the homes purportedly, I'm guessing, you know, very innocently to try to help this thing do its job, for lack of a better way of saying it. And then they started realizing, hey, wait a minute, we've got all these floor plans now. This could be a good, viable source of another revenue stream. And so they began to shop this around. I mean, why does this thing need, you know, I don't know, maybe it can't store the information in its own brain? So you have to send this back to home base?
Yeah, good point. If their motives were benign, they could have, it could have a memory and just use the data that it collects, you know, for the purposes that it was intended. But once they start uploading to the internet or to the Internet of Things, then it becomes a spy device in your home.
Yeah.
You bought a device to spy on yourself.
And people are buying spy devices to surveil themselves every day. The Echo.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that what's going to happen ultimately in the future is that you will never actually own anything. If there is a chip in it, and the device can be controlled remotely, which is, or, you know, collect information or whatever, send and receive information. Basically, they can say, well, like with your washing machine, you bought the washing machine, you've had 800 washes with it, shut it down and don't start it up again.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you might have to call a repairman to refresh, reboost your washing machine.
And they'll have a good excuse. They'll have a good excuse. They'll say, well, this is
critical. Yeah, so basically you will not own anything. You will just be leasing it because they control it.
You're right.
If you don't control it, if it's not yours, built to last, so to speak, then you're basically just renting it.
It's planned obsolescence encoded in the software. We'll be back here, folks. Stay with us. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Vicki Davis is here. And the website is governamerica.com. That's my website, or our website for the broadcast here. And Vicki's website is thetechnocratictyranny.com and channelingreality.com. And she also is a contributor to The Voice of Idaho. That's TVOINews.net. TVOINews.net. So anyway, we have a phone call on the line from Kentucky. Do you have anything you wanted to add before we go to the phones there, Vicki?
No, go ahead.
All right. Let me go ahead and hit the button and put them on the air. Hello, caller. Who do we have here? Uh-oh. What did I do here? Oh, wrong button. Okay, start over. Start
mapping.
Over. Yeah,
Hi, Darren. Hi, Vicki. Great show as always. This is Dan in Kentucky.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear now.
Yeah, okay. Well, you were talking about the robot mapping.
Uh-huh.
I think what's really going on is connected with CERN and the collider, because I think what the Luciferians are doing is trying to create a virtual reality world. A lot of the NSA people are freaking out because we don't need all of this mapping of homes and everything for security. This is way, way, way beyond. And I think what they're doing is, and I've heard other people say this, that they're creating a virtual reality that they hope they can sucker people into and create a force field that will trap their souls. And DARPA and the Pentagon is spending tons of black budget money to create virtual reality identities for everybody. Alan Watt mentions that all the time. And the CERN experiment is, you know, to create a hole in the universe or a wormhole. God knows what they think they're doing, making themselves gods. Mm-hmm. But if they can create something like Project Bluebeam, where they're using the chemtrails to ionize the atmosphere to make a big screen so it looks like Jesus is coming back, you know, they could scare people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if they do this virtual reality thing, claiming that aliens have invaded or something, you know, when they did the War of the Worlds in the 30s as an experiment, Orson Welles said four times it was just a radio play and people freaked out anyway. You know, it's not hard to get people, you know, a crowd psychology like that. But I think what
we're living in a world of virtual reality, Dan. I mean, everywhere we turn.
Oh, yeah, all the time. You're right.
We have staged events all over the place, and this is the problem. It's come to the point where we don't know what's real and what isn't real. And I, frankly, have gotten tired of trying to sit here and figure it out. I mean, all you have to know is just keep in the back of your mind that half of what we see and hear is fiction, maybe even more than half, or less than half of what we see is real. So, yeah.
Well, and also I want to say that what you said about capturing the soul, that sounds pretty crazy, but in fact, if the degree to which they implement central planning, if they achieve that, then people become just basically objects within the plan. They lose all of their own humanity, their ability to think independently and act independently. Everything in your life will be scripted, you know, from the moment you wake
That's
up
right.
until the moment you go to sleep. So you do lose your soul.
Yeah, and I don't.
And the way they do that, Vicki, is to skew the perception of a contract. For example, we're born, and by our birth certificate, we have signed a contract, but we haven't consented to it or anything. So their whole deal is to give you the legal appearance of a contract, but not the spirit of having knowingly participated in what you want to do. So there's theories about free will, that the only free will we have is each choice to choose either good or evil, because, you know, we don't have wings and we can't fly and there's a lot of ways we're limited. But if they can set it up to scare people, then people will, without knowing they're being set up, go into some kind of virtual reality or make some choices, and then their souls will be trapped in some kind of a force field, even more than we are trapped already. And Darren, I think the only way I use to determine what's real and not real is the Hegelian dialectic. Always there's some forced choice or Hegelian goal in a virtual reality that you don't have when you're dealing with real choices and, you know, non-fake news.
Look for the agenda that's hidden in the events.
Setting up things to scare people, isn't that exactly what they're doing with all of this terrorism? Terrorism has become the motivating force, the operating principle for the government. But the fallacy in it is that they are importing, they are allowing the import of the terrorists. They're putting them right in our neighborhoods.
Well, that
when an event happens, like they shoot somebody or, you know, run people over in cars, they act like it's a very normal thing. This is all very, very normal. But, you know, at a different level, the whole government is focused on fighting terrorism. It's pure insanity.
That's a fraud.
Yeah, it is a fraud.
You know, It's like all of these things, the FBI hasn't found any terrorists, and there's been a lot of sting operations, and we're funding ISIS, and the head of ISIS is Shimon Elliott, who's a Mossad agent. That's who Baghdadi really is. I mean, that's not even a Muslim name. It's a city, you know? But, you know, they're making up all this stuff, and they keep changing all this. It's like 1984. Are you at war with Eurasia or East Asia, you know?
Yeah.
And they keep changing the names, you know, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Daesh and all these, you know.
And we're aligned with the groups. We're aligned with the groups, and we've always been aligned with the groups until we're not aligned with the groups, and then we've always been at war with the groups.
Yeah, yeah. So they make it each way. I knew a woman years ago, and her brother was in the DEA, and he went down to South America to fight drugs and found out, you know, half of the government was promoting the drugs. So they're all fighting each other, and they get black budgets either way, because that's the Hegelian dialectic. That's how you tell what's virtual reality or what isn't. You know, when they come out with all these false choices, you know, their goal is, you know, more control and whatever, and anything that really empowers people isn't in that vein, because it empowers people to be individuals and thinking and get out of their system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Hey, thanks,
that,
Dan.
That soul angle is really clever, because, you know, people have signed up, you know, all these sovereignty issues. You know, there's some things that people don't have to do that they just are accustomed to do. And, you know, if they can scare people into doing something, you know, like sheep, then they can create some kind of force field that would capture people's souls. Because
yeah,
a lot of people are getting to the point, you, like they said, you said, Darren, you don't know what reality you're in.
You know what? I really love the way you describe that as a force field, because I, for a long time, I've really felt like I am an outsider to the larger society, and using the analogy of a force field, there within a force field of a virtual reality, it makes sense why I feel like an outsider. I'm not in that force field.
Right.
Because I read.
And the other part of that is that evil works by forcing choices on people. You don't have any choice. You know, they start all these things voluntary, and then, you know, you don't have any choice, like TSA and all of these other things. But evil works by forced choices upon us, and we have to deal with evil by using forced choices on them, like that time in Colorado where the farmers got together and blocked the wildlife people and said, you will not close this road. The ranchers and farmers are using it. Remember, you had that one on there in a mm-hmm. year or so ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, that happened in Idaho,
understand.
I think, that, or Nevada. Or it was the Sagebrush Rebellion, right?
Yeah, right. Right, or our co-op here, I think I told you the story about raw milk. They tried to shut us down, the health department, and we called the legislators over Memorial Day 5 years ago at home, and the health department got a black eye and made a mistake, and then we still have raw milk for our members. And then they said, well, we've got them on the run, so we went up to Pennsylvania, and we called the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, and said, Monday we'll be transferring raw milk over state lines, which is illegal, and we're going to hand it out free to people. And they had SWAT teams there at NIH, and then they went down to the mall and gave them out, and, you know, cops were there, and, you know, people were going over and knocking on their windows and saying, hey, you want some raw milk? It's really good, you know? And we didn't have any violence at all because we had them on the run.
Huh.
Then you had like Morningside, remember, and Baker's Green Acres and all these other places, you know, Rawson Milk in California that got shut down. This is the only victory I know that we've had, and it was because we had out-of-box solutions and got people and forced them and embarrassed them because all the legislatures called up the health department and says, what are you trying to pull? These people are a co-op. They don't sell anything. This is for their members, you know?
You know, and what you're describing right here just proves my point, Dan. And I got another call on the line, so I'm going to have to move on here real quick. But my point has been, if there are enough people involved, there are things that can be done to at least push back or stay this thing. And if enough people are persistent enough, it can be reversed. You've just given us an example of how it can happen.
Yeah.
So
there's always a way that it's out of the box. It's thinking of things that they don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they're thinking in group psychology, think tanking people, what are people going to do? But they can never predict what an individual is going to come up with, a new strategy.
Yeah.
That's their weak point, and that's when we always win.
I love the cuckoo clock in the background there, too. Hey, I'm going to move on, but I appreciate...
Come up with something they think would be cuckoo, yeah.
appreciate the call there, buddy.
Great show. You all are wonderful. Right. God bless
Thank you. God bless you, too. All right, we'll move on here and take the next call. And this is from Missouri. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Howdy, this is Ron.
Hi, Ron.
Since we're talking about not the world of reality, we went to the Senior Expo, and we seen this large print phone, and it sounded pretty neat. So we had the guy come out yesterday, and Sam and Pat did some research, and they're very good researchers, as you know. Well, they're from Missouri Liberty Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And this phone is called Claritine. Things sounded kind of neat until... He said it had to be connected to the landline, which, of course, it does, and then to the Ethernet. I'm like, well, now, why does it have to be connected to the net? He goes, well, it has caption displays, this caller ID, it does, if your doctor says, Darren, come in at 9 a.m. tomorrow, you press save, and it'll save that entry for you. All of these neat features. But I kept saying, yeah, but why do we need the net? And he never would really answer my questions.
Uh-huh.
Well,
I heard it just right there. The doctor's appointment.
Right. So Sam and Pat began doing some research, and this, I wish I remember the name of the government group she said. Pat and Sam are probably calling and tell you, but it's under 508, and the phone system is called Clarity. And apparently what happens is when this thing is doing all of its translating, it's going back to their customer service center, and then coming back to you. And so then the next question I had with this whole mess.
So wait a minute. Let me get this straight. All your calls are going to the service center? Is that what you said?
No, only apparently they do, so they can do this captioning and typing to make it in large print for the visually impaired and for the hearing impaired.
So they're listening in on everything. I mean, they have the potential.
Darren, they would not do that, Darren.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure they must have a contract that says they won't do it.
I must just be one of those conspiracy theorists. I'm sorry.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you two got to stop this conspiracy stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So the question I asked Sam, I said, okay, if this thing is connected to the net, can they tap into the other part of my network? And he goes, that's a very good question. Well, I immediately, when the guy left, uncoupled this thing from the net. Now, the phone still does work, but it's not what my wife needs, something to amplify her voice going out, not coming in. So we're not going to keep this phone anyway. But when we unhooked it from the net, Peggy says, hey, there's a display that says, if you need help, contact customer service. I went, they know we're not connected to them.
Huh.
Now, oh, yeah, I'm sure you become a node on their network, and they can monitor everything.
A rebellious slave.
Uh-huh.
Disconnected from the Matrix.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see all kinds of possibilities for that, because, you know, if they can hook up to your doctor's office, remind you of your appointment, And then, you know, your automobile, you know, remind you that you need an oil change. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on once they can connect you, have permission to connect you up to the commercial world.
You know what it reminds me of?
Wait, who said they had my permission?
Well, you installed it, didn't you?
But I didn't read the agreement.
Oh, darn it.
Well, that's too bad. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. But you know what it reminds me of, Ron, is that Star Trek episode where the Borg, where you had one rebellious Borg, and he disconnected from his from the Matrix, from what they call the It wasn't the Matrix back then. It was I forget what they call their grid. But anyway, he disconnected himself, and he was being lectured and strongly advised he'd better reconnect.
Yeah, see, they want to assimilate you.
Yes, of course.
And so what this phone does, Vic, is kind of, I did send Darren, too, which you played a good story about that robot vacuum, because I sent one up to Darren, too. And this phone, what it does is, we were conferencing Sam and playing with this thing with this guy here, and that thing was typing. Peggy could read everything that Sam and I was saying to each other going back through their network back over to this phone.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And could they turn this microphone on and off anytime they wanted from their network?
Well, we know that they can do that with our cell phones. The Google, I don't know if it's Google that has an app, but yeah, they with law enforcement, they can do that. They can turn on your phone and use it as a microphone.
Yeah, and their phones are electronically listening all the time. Many of them, anyway, are.
Except for my 20-year-old flip phone.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you never know when that one could be opened up.
Too old technology.
Well, I don't know.
I know. I'm going to get a nasty letter from Sprint saying we will no longer provide service to this phone.
As long as you're paying your bill, I mean, these people are horrors. They don't care. I mean, corporate
but anyway,
CEOs.
This thing is called a Clarity phone. You go Google Clarity, Pat came right up with it, started reading their terms of agreements and all their service center stuff. And so if you know anybody that one of these senior fairs or whatever, are they're trying to be so nice to you and help you be connected into the network, there's all these strings attached.
Hmm.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a guy knock on my door a few days ago, and he wanted me to sign up for a security system so that if I need to call 911, you know, I just push a button or whatever. They provide all of the equipment and I just pay a monthly fee, but they're connected right directly into like the fire department or the police department. And so they act as an interface.
Hey, Vic, you start your conversation again because I hit a button. I was trying to move something, and I hit a phone disconnect button, so I totally overrode you. So start your thing again about the security guy.
Oh, he was trying to sell me a security package, provide security for my home. They provide all of the equipment, and they're connected right directly into the fire department and to the 911 system. And if I have any problems at all, you know, I just push a button or whatever. But it's the same kind of thing, you know. They're not just monitoring my home, they're monitoring me. You know, so if they put electronic locks on my door, they know every time I go in and out. There's all kinds of sensors that they can put in those devices.
Yep.
And so basically, you know, they want to give me the equipment to put spy equipment in my house so that I can get faster 911 service. They get priority 911 service, according to this guy.
Well, it's kind of like, again, I said it before, it's like Santa Claus without the presents.
Yeah.
You know, they see you when they're sleeping. They know when you're awake. You know, I mean, it fits.
I have to say it wasn't very nice to... I told the guy, I said, I will never sign up for your system. Because really what it boils down to, they're trying to privatize 911. They're trying to privatize everything, you know? Elimination of the government. And quite frankly, I'd rather have a government than a corporation.
Yeah. I mean, either can be evil, but at least with the system we have, you have certain things in place that you can potentially reclaim. Mm-hmm. With a corporation, everything's proprietary. They don't have to comply with FOIA. They don't have to comply with Open Meetings Act. You know, I mean, you have some accountability with government agency, well, you know, organizations.
Theoretically, government should be working for the people.
Exactly.
And that's what we're all trying to do, is to get it back in its box.
It's supposed to be consent of the governed.
Yeah. But with a corporation,
you govern yourself.
I mean, they can do anything they want. And yeah, you can sue. Really? If you can afford to hire a $200 an hour attorney, and if he decides to take your case, you can sue. But if you're like me and can't afford to hire an attorney, you're just kind of SOL.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Ron. That's true. You know, I didn't know anything about 508. I know that 504, you know, government stuff deals with discrimination with the disabled and so forth, so forth. So I'm not sure a whole lot about 508. There might be one you might want to link into, and since this phone is linked in through the 508, I know it has something to do with government grants, disabilities, and apparently this group has all kinds of phones for vision, hearing, dexterity, so they're happy to take care of just about anybody they can possibly help.
Sure.
You know what? Yeah, I will check into that, because it might be the same network, but for a different, you know, as FirstNet, which is the independent agency that is going to be the nation's 911 service provider. So they've been spun off and basically privatized.
Mm-hmm.
So it might actually be a part of that network.
You never know. By the way, one more thing I've got out. Darren, I did send you the story. It's called What is a Life Worth? It's the whole story about Charlie, the disabled baby over in England. He died yesterday.
Yeah, Charlie Gard.
Yeah.
So I put the BBC story up there, and they interviewed the parents, and it was quite an interesting little story there. Also, I sent you kind of a funny one about a guy that got locked inside of an ATM machine.
Oh, geez.
So if you need a good laugh, there you go.
That sounds like a day ruiner.
Really? He didn't have a cell phone either. He was sending out his messages for help through the money spot.
Oh, gosh. That's incredible.
Anyway, it's kind of a funny story. But anyway, I'll let you get to the next phone caller.
All right. Hey, thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. We're at the top of the hour, so we're going to have to take a break first. But you're welcome to call in, folks, if you want. 844-646-8376. We'll be back.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
So just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5, this is the second hour of Govern America. Mickey Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. And it continues to be the 29th of July, 2017, as we get right back into it here. Well, since Ron brought it up and they're talking about it in the chat room, it's a real short clip, so I'll go ahead and play the man stuck inside the ATM machine.
Contractor became stuck inside an ATM in Corpus Christi, Texas. The contractor was there to fix a door lock and became locked inside of the small room that houses the ATM without his phone. So he started slipping messages for help to the customers on the outside. The man did get out of the room after a couple of hours, all thanks to some help from his boss and police.
That's insane. So slipping notes through the money slot.
On in the 1960s, it.
What'd you say?
I said that kind of reminds me of a program that was on in the 1960s called Candid Camera.
Oh yeah.
If you start getting messages from the ATM, you know, I'd be looking around for the camera. You know, that's
that would be a good prank.
Recording me acting stupid.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, that would be a great prank. Anyway, or to slip out Monopoly money out of the slot and wonder, you know, when people see this colorful money come out. Of course, the real stuff probably isn't much more valuable or any more valuable than the Monopoly money. But I digress.
Except the grocery store does take the Monopoly money. They don't take the fake stuff. So
yeah. Well, all of it's fake if you want to boil it down. But anyway, we're splitting hairs now. So the White House is in chaos, it looks like. You know, the media has been saying that, but more and more it looks like, and of course, the created chaos, and I'm still trying to figure out if all this isn't just a big giant dog and pony show. Of course, we got Reince Priebus out now. John Kelly is in as chief of staff. It'll be interesting to see if the leaks stop.
Yeah, that makes me really nervous, John Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the segment at the Aspen Forum. I know we're not there yet, but he was head of Southern Command, and you know, which is the regional, global, military command, part of the military command structure. And he spent time in the Middle East, and he talked about how he went to the mosques and did the prayers and all of that stuff. But, I mean, it sounds like he's Catholic, but at least with the Muslims, if you go pray with them, they consider you a Muslim. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. That makes me really quite nervous.
Yeah, and another thing that's going on that I think people should be aware of is the investigation with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Now, the FBI has just raided his home, seized hard drives that were smashed.
You should say what's his name? Awan?
Awan, yeah. Awan, yeah. Let me see, where is his name? Because he's got one of those Middle Eastern type names. Imran.
Imran Awan.
Imran Awan or Awan Imran. I think it's Imran Awan. It's a really difficult name. Let's see. It's got to be in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. It's Imran Awan. That's his name. But anyway, they apparently raided his house and seized these hard drives. And then afterwards, he had wired nearly $300,000 to Pakistan and was making a run for it.
With $12,000 in cash.
Well, his wife had 12 grand in cash.
They all did.
Well, they all did. Okay. All right. And so I guess they let her go, which I'm still kind of wondering about. But the interesting thing about all of this is you can say, well, this is, you know, and everybody out there, I see I'm on the Twitter, oh, they're getting close, they're investigating. No, folks. Because here's the thing. The fix is in on this whole process. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, her brother is overseeing the investigation.
Are you kidding me?
No. No, her brother is the assistant U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., who is overseeing the Imran Awan investigation.
What's his name?
Oh, you would ask that. I'll find it. I got it here. Give me just a second. How do I have it? Steve Wasserman.
Steve Wasserman. That is unbelievable.
Well, what's unbelievable is that you didn't know it. What's unbelievable is that I didn't know it until two or three days ago when somebody sent it to me on Twitter. And this is the thing. Why isn't the media reporting this? Oh, Jeff Sessions, he's got to recuse himself. Ah, he's in, bed with the Russians and all this Russian. And then you got this blatant conflict of interest going on right here. And nary is a word. I mean, it is just absolutely nothing from the establishment media.
And why would they let the woman go, the wife of A1, because she was on the payroll too.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't let somebody go when they're making off with cash and the husband is under investigation. So, I don't know. This guy might, he was arrested by the FBI. He may end up going to prison. But if he does, it's just going to be another fall for those that orbit around the Clintons. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is one of those.
Yeah. Well,
this
corruption. She kept these A1 people on the payroll for 5 months after it was discovered that they were stealing equipment.
Well, she might have instructed him to do that.
Well, probably she did.
He may have been doing his job.
it's not the value of the machine, it's the value of the information. And the access provided by a member of Congress's or an aide, actually. An aide probably would be more valuable than the machine of a member of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Because the aides probably, without a doubt, do more of the actual work.
Yeah, this is just incredible. But we do have another call on the line, so let me go ahead and go to Kansas. And hello, caller, who do we have here?
Hey, you guys, this is Sherry.
Hey, Sherry, good to hear from you.
Hey, going back to the last hour where you were talking about technology and those RFID things and stuff, are either of you familiar with a discipline called iridology?
Is that eye scans?
Yeah,
fruit. Yeah.
Well, there's a discipline that some of alternative health people use to, they can look at the iris of your eye and tell things about your health.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I see, this stuff about using an eye scan for identification and access and stuff. I think they could, be able to pick out a weak system in your body and exploit that if they really wanted to.
Hmm.
Well, I'm not sure. It's hard to say, how much of what they say is true and how much is fiction. Now, they can tell from your eyes. I'm sure they can tell a little bit. If your eyes are dull, there may be... they can tell some things by that, but as to whether or not your kidneys are functioning well, I don't know. I would kind of tend to doubt that.
Well, I have some information on Dr. John Ray Christopher's stuff, and he died in 1983, and he practiced for several years. It goes back before World War II. And he used to talk about using iridology to, and you can tell things like that in that if you're accomplished enough, because he would talk about that in some of his cases in that. And the other thing I heard the other day, and maybe you can verify this, Vicki, I heard a guy who talks about protecting yourself from EMF. He said that it takes a lot more energy to send out all this wireless stuff than it does for you know, cable hookups and through wires and stuff. So if we're supposed to be saving energy and, you know, trying to conserve energy and stuff, why are they trying to force us all on this wireless crap?
Well, I mean, you'd have to go through a cost and benefit analysis. Not everything boils down to just simply cost. It really helps police to have wireless, obviously, because, well, just for a lot of reasons. It helps a lot of businesses to have wireless, so that, you know, they have instant communications, instant access to information.
Are you talking about the smart grids? Are you talking about
the smart meters? She's talking about the cost, energy, the usage of energy versus the need for wireless. And so what I was trying to explain is that not everything comes down to cost. Sometimes when you're weighing the cost benefit of something, the benefit outweighs the cost. So in the equation of energy versus the convenience of wireless, the benefits of wireless outweighs the cost.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Yes, but they don't balance that against the health risk either.
Of course not. They don't care.
I went to this guy's website.
They don't care about us.
Yeah. I went to this guy's website, and I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with this late Dr. Magda Havas.
No.
I believe she's up in Canada, but she's got done a lot on the health dangers of these frequencies and stuff. And he's got a little video from her where she looked at her own blood. She did it before she, you know, for a baseline, before she was around, used any of these wireless devices.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly normal. And then she used the computer for 70 minutes, and then took another sample and looked at it, and her blood began to clump.
Huh.
And then she, you know, used her wireless phone, and I can't remember how long it was, but I think it was only about 10 minutes or so, and it was even worse. And it was really amazing, and you can imagine these people that are on it all the time.
Yeah, which is unfortunately most of the population.
Yeah.
Well, we do have iron in our blood. So if you're getting shot with electromagnetic waves, you know, that kind of makes a little bit of sense.
And not only that, but they're in the microwave frequency level.
So maybe the thing is that you need to be iron poor instead of iron rich.
Well,
except your iron helps you carry your oxygen.
Oh, oops.
So, yeah, that is
okay,
a drawback.
That's all I had. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Sherry. Appreciate the call there. Talk to you later. There she is, Sherry in Kansas. Well, the other thing that we have going on here is that the FBI agent, you're familiar with the guy that got indicted for killing Lavoie Finicum. He's now hired a very high-profile D.C. lawyer. So this guy was representing a congressman, and I'm... okay, the FBI hostage rescue team member, his name is W. Joseph Estrada. He's now hired... retained... Robert Kerry, who is a well-known in the nation's capital for his defense of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. And Ted Stevens, this attorney got Ted Stevens off, so he's probably pretty good at, you know, making his Masonic connections. And this is my assumptions. I have no proof. But anyway, I just thought I'd update people on that story. Now, a very high, powerful attorney has been hired in that case.
I assume the government is going to be paying for it, although I don't know why they would, because he was not following the law and is therefore not covered by the government liability protection.
That would be an incredible slap in the face, isn't it? If that turned out to be true, the government is somehow paying for this guy's attorney. But I wouldn't be surprised. You know, here on one hand, they're going to prosecute him to put up a show, and then on the other hand, they would be paying for his defense. All of this is speculative, of course, because
they get some junior varsity government attorney to be the government's side.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So we also have an FBI lawyer allegedly under investigation for leaking classified information to the media. FBI General Counsel James Baker, according to Circa.com, is purportedly under a Department of Justice criminal investigation, allegedly leaking classified national security information to the media, according to multiple government officials close to the probe who spoke with Circa on the condition of anonymity. So that's another one of those things you can take with a grain of salt, because the sources are anonymous. And when the sources are anonymous, I tend to discount it.
Yeah. And also, in one of those sessions at Aspen, maybe it was a different program that I was listening to, but anyway, the guy said that when a government official gets in trouble for doing something, the question is asked, did he really do it? And the guy said, of course he did it. The question is, whose toes did he step on politically that they're going to prosecute him for it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we played that last week, I believe.
Oh, okay. It was that Russia deal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was talking about the way things are in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the same way here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So Trump says transgender people will not be allowed in the military. That's good. So I'm waiting for the court lawsuit on that one to put a stay on that, because you know, you almost know it's coming. And in the meantime, over in Euroland, we have a machine-wielding man screaming Allahu Akbar and killing one person and injuring several others during a rampage in Hamburg, Germany. This is the latest thing that, this is fresh off, happened apparently, I guess, just yesterday. So, more cultural enrichment.
What's wrong with that, Darren? That's all normal.
Well, and that's exactly what they're saying in these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, let me jump to North Korea real quick, because they just conducted another test yesterday of an ICBM. We talked about this earlier. It's claimed, and of course, everything the media says, we have to take with a grain of salt. But what is claimed by some of the quote-unquote experts is that this puts, you know, some, and some even say, the entire United States within range. Now, again, keep in mind, the media's job is to sell you war. They love war because war brings ratings. And they're going nuts with the fear-mongering. Now, Adam Mount is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, well, of course, George Soros' organization. And, you know, does Soros stand to make any money off of investments, you know, from war? I think he does. So everything's got to really be kept in a proper perspective. But he's up on being interviewed on CNN, and, you know, it's just, like I say, a lot of alarmism, a lot of fear-mongering. My thinking on North Korea and Kim Jong-un is that a lot of this stuff is probably just deterrent.
I have a presidential transition report that was given to George W. Bush when he went into office. And every country that the RAND report listed as on the bad list, we've taken out now except North Korea.
Yeah.
So what this whole thing is that they're just taking out the governments of countries that are not participating in the international order.
There you go. Exactly.
And that's all that that's all it is. You know, probably that guy in North Korea feels threatened. No doubt he feels threatened.
Well, if he has any sense, which you don't maintain power like that unless you do have some sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to, I'm sure there's a lot of intimidation going on. I'm not saying he's a good guy, but we have to look at things as objectively as we possibly can with the information that we have, and we know we're being fed garbage. But
yeah. I'm sure
if he has any sense, he's going to try to do something to defend himself because he's looking at all these other quote-unquote axis of evil neighbors, and they're all being taken out.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he's a very bad guy, but that's not the point. The point is that North Korea is a country.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a people, they have a society, a culture, and we may not like it, but who are we to do anything about it? I don't know. I just believe that people have a right to live the way that they want to in their country.
Yeah.
And
you're one of these sticks in the mud that believe in national sovereignty.
Yes.
How dare
national
you?
National sovereignty. And national sovereignty also means that you don't go take out other governments because you don't agree with them.
Listen, we're just spreading democracy. We're just spreading freedom around the world.
Assuming it is the latter, it is a new missile, it isn't a North Korean version of an ICBM, then President Trump's options. I mean, wherever we look here, you've got Beijing has options. You've got South Korea has options. You've got the Japanese, where it landed in their exclusive economic zone, have options. But ultimately, the leadership has to come here, surely, from the U.S. president.
Well, if it is true that this missile flew for about 45 minutes, it seems very likely that it was an ICBM. This would be the second test of a North Korean ICBM. That's capable of reaching targets in the United States. We suspected that the Hwasong-14, the ICBM that was tested a few weeks ago, was capable of reaching targets in the continental United States. And it looks as though North Korea is trying to demonstrate what this missile can do. Now, President Trump, as you mentioned, has limited options, but he has important imperatives. It's important that in the near term, he stands up and says, conclusively and with resolve, that we're prepared to defend our allies. The purpose of an ICBM test is to make allies doubt that we have their backs and we're willing to come to their defense. But so far, I've seen very little evidence that this administration has acknowledged or is adjusting its policy to account for a North Korean ICBM.
All right, Adam, humor me for this question, please, because at the end of the day, whether it's the July the 4th, 5th launch, or today's launch, there's an element of irrelevance about which one we are talking about, because there is also an inevitability, it would seem at the moment, that eventually the North Koreans are going to crack this nut and find a way to launch an ICBM that could have a viable missile on it. So we come back to what are President Trump's options, dealing with the fact that at some point, unless action taken sooner rather than later, they will be able to attack the U.S.
You know what?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think it's important to
go ahead.
If the U.S. military, if the Navy does not have the capability to shoot down a missile, I want a refund on all the tax dollars that I paid that went to the Pentagon for the development of technology to do that. Because what they're saying there takes me back to the 1960s, you know, when they were so worried about all this missile technology, and then 40 years of just hundreds, trillions of dollars going to the Pentagon to develop technology to be able to shoot down a missile. And now they're talking about, the way they're talking, it's as if the United States has no technology whatsoever to shoot down a missile. See, I don't know why they don't have a ship planted out there in the ocean. They said that there was a missile flying around for half an hour.
Yeah.
Well, what, you know, why was it flying around
over
for
a half
an
hour?
Why wasn't it shot down?
Well, that's a very good point, because they're lying.
That's right.
They don't have that technology.
Yeah, they're just conditioning the public, you know, for war with North Korea to take out that government.
And I think we have to keep in mind who sold North Korea nuclear technology in the first place.
Right, Bill Clinton.
No, it was Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, was it Rumsfeld?
Yeah, Rumsfeld's company back in 2000 did a $200 million contract to sell nuclear reactors to North Korea. They wouldn't even have the technology had Rumsfeld not sold it. You know, and then right after that, you know, in the PNAC report, then he's naming. Actually, it was the same year, really. It was the same year. Now that I think about it, because Project for the New American Century report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, was published in September of 2000. That was the year that Rumsfeld's company, ABB, which is a European engineering giant based in Zurich, they sold the technology to North Korea. So as Rumsfeld's company was selling the technology to North Korea, you had him and his buddies at the PNAC group putting out information about regime change, naming North Korea as part of the axis of evil.
They set him up, basically.
Yeah, the whole thing is bullcrap. The whole thing is a complete and utter setup situation. It's sick. These people are sick. Tell you what, we're late for the break. Let's take the break. We'll be back. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. As we continue on, we've been talking a little bit about North Korea, just touching briefly upon the missile test that took place yesterday and what a setup situation it is. But everything is a setup situation, ladies and gentlemen. We live in an artificial reality, and that seems to be more and more apparent all the time. Of course, now we have South Korea and they're firing missiles. The U.S. and South Korea fired missiles in response to the North Korea ballistic missile launch. So we got that going on, that according to the Voice of America. And then China is staging, according to the South China Morning Post, China is staging a high-profile naval drill off the Korean Peninsula. Now, China could have done more to rein in North Korea themselves. But China, their position is, well, the United States is using provocation by holding war games off the Korean Peninsula with South Korea. And so they say, how can we talk to Kim Jong-un when you guys are you know, conducting your war games? Kind of hard for us to use deterrence.
And so, see, that's the thing that irritates me so much about their, quote, virtual reality that they've created. It doesn't even make sense. There is no logic to it. You have to have the memory of a turnip to believe any of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, and most people do, unfortunately, have the memory of a turnip, or, as I like to say, a common housefly. Mm-hmm. It's just depressing. And then the other thing about it is, at the same time that we have the situation going on with North Korea, we also have more sanctions going into place on Russia. The Republicans in Congress just forwarded a bill Paul Craig Roberts, up on the website at governamerica.com, we have a piece by Paul Craig Roberts. He did a really good piece. He says, what is the Congress up to with their stupid bill that imposes more sanctions and removes the power of President Trump to rescind the sanctions that President Obama imposed? Congress is doing two things, Roberts says. One is that Congress is serving their campaign contributors in the military/security complex by being tougher with Russia, thus keeping the orchestrated threat alive so that Americans denied health care don't start looking for the massive military security budget as a place to find money for health care. The other is to put President Trump in a box. And this is the key, folks. He says if Trump vetoes this encroachment on presidential power, Congress and the prostitute media will present the veto as absolute proof that Trump is a Russian agent and is protecting Russia with his veto. If Trump does not veto the bill, Trump will have thrown in his hand and accepted that he cannot reduce the dangerous tensions with Russia. In other words, the bill is a lose-lose for Trump, yet Republicans are supporting the bill, thus undermining their president. Mm-hmm. So he goes on from there. That article will be in the show notes. The point is that now Trump has caved to the pressure, and he says he will sign the Russian sanctions bill. Then you have the Russians have just come out now, and they just seized U.S. diplomatic facilities.
Moscow has told Washington to cut diplomatic staff at its U.S. embassy in Russia and said it was seizing two U.S. diplomatic properties. Moscow says it is in retaliation to what it calls the proposed illegal U.S. sanctions. The move comes just a day after Vladimir Putin warned a response was imminent.
At some point, we will have to respond. It is impossible to endlessly endure offensive behavior towards our country.
The announcement came as the U.S. Senate voted to apply new sanctions against Russia. Washington says the sanctions are aimed at punishing Russia for its alleged interference in the U.S. presidential election in 2016.
Moscow says that the United States has until 1st of September to reduce its diplomatic staff in Russia to 455. This is the same number of Russian diplomats Moscow says were left in the United States after Washington expelled 35 of them in December.
At the same time as it expelled the Russian diplomats, the outgoing Obama administration seized two Russian diplomatic compounds. So now, as well as telling Washington to cut its diplomats, Moscow says it will be seizing a holiday property used by U.S. diplomats and the diplomatic warehouse in Moscow from 1st of August.
I think the whole idea of expulsion of Russian diplomats from Obama's administration, it was to make a possible recovery of U.S.-Russian relations more difficult, because if you want to repair relations, you need people to do it.
Relations between Russia and the U.S. have deteriorated further after U.S. intelligence agencies accused Moscow of trying to sway last year's election in favor of Trump. Moscow flatly denies this accusation. Julia Lubova, CGTN, Moscow.
That was CGTN, which is the South. It was that's actually a Chinese news network, which is kind of interesting. Now we're getting "quote unquote" news from the Chinese, but I figured that's a report that probably is a little more objective since it's not about China themselves.
Yeah, well, you know what? The ending of the Cold War and the whole idea of a one world, a peaceful world, doesn't serve the interests of the defense contractors. They tried to repurpose them to develop all of this technology for peaceful use, you know, the Internet of Things and chips and everything. And the deal is that they're still working on all of that, but as far as the business for the big military hardware, you can't justify that unless you have an enemy out there. Mm-hmm. And that so it really hurt when they no longer had the evil empire of the Soviet Union. So I really do believe that they have to recreate the Cold War.
Gotta have boogeyman.
Yeah, if you don't have a boogeyman, I mean, what is there to do? Go on a picnic with your family?
And again, this was the subject. Again, I come back to the Iron Mountain Report, the report from Iron Mountain on the possibility and desirability of peace. How do we control the population? How do we deal with people in the absence of war? War is a great tool to manipulate people and control people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, make profits. You know, I don't recall seeing that mentioned in there, but it's certainly a reality.
They've tried to make pollution the enemy,
yep.
the enemy of the world. And along with the idea that the first caller was talking about, you know, invasion of aliens from space and God returning and all of,
yeah, Project
all of
Blue
those
Beam.
Things.
Yeah, the
yeah.
And what they're talking about, and they mentioned that in the report as well, the or Iron Mountain Report. You know, it could be that aliens from outer space, you know, some kind of orchestrated UFO invasion could be used as a tool. And you've had people like Ronald Reagan, even and Bill Clinton. I've got clips here that I think I played before on the broadcast. I won't do it again, but. Where they've referenced that, you know, I wonder if we had an invasion from outside, from beyond, how long would it take for people to come together to fend off this common attack? This is the way they think.
Practice duck and covering, you know, for the space alien invasion.
Yeah, 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 it's just incredible. And then we have RT, the Russian outlet. Coming out with a story just yesterday, weaponizing viruses, U.S. Air Force places ad for bio samples from Russians. The U.S. Air Force is looking to acquire samples of a ribonucleic acid, or RNA, and synovial fluid from Russians, according to a government website used to place tenders. The reason behind the order hasn't been specified. The Air Force's Air Education and Training Command has placed a listing on the Federal Business Opportunities website asking for at least 12 RNA samples from Russian people of a European ancestry, as well as 27 samples of the synovial fluid. Suppliers of the samples must meet a number of requirements. And it goes on from there. But the question, of course, is, why would they need the sample? What would they need the samples for? They speculate one reason could only be purely medical research. But, of course, then you've got the other hand where maybe they're using these things to weaponize people or to weaponize the viruses.
Yeah, towards a specific, if they can find a common genetic heritage amongst the Russian people, then they can formulate some kind of biological weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... We're in a very bad area of time. And
yeah, all of the technology, it seems that all of the technology that is being developed today is for the detriment of humanity. Not the benefit of humanity, but the detriment of humanity.
Which brings me to the Aspen Security Forum. Since we're talking about global security, this is another one of those. Of course, the Aspen Institute, do you want to say anything about them? They're all funded by all the foundations.
The Aspen Institute is probably amongst the worst of the of these forums
think
that
tanks.
Include. It's kind of like Davos, but it's here in Colorado at Aspen, but it's a forum where business leaders, military leaders, government officials, and media get together to discuss world problems. You know, whatever the problem is, you know, they have different themes that they organize conferences around.
Yeah.
And
Then the foundations are all in. You got the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller, Carnegie. All of them are all in with the...
Right. One of the big sponsors was Lockheed. Of course, they're very into
No, that couldn't possibly be true. Wouldn't that be a conflict of interest? These are policymakers.
This is like your privatized Congress, these people that getting together and discussing the future of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it probably this goes way back, but I think Rockefeller was very much involved in organizing the first conferences of influence, people of influence, to discuss possible solutions to global problems.
Yeah, and boy, have we got a lot of solutions.
Yeah, none of them for the benefit of... actually, and it really has nothing to do with the lives of regular people. Everything that they talk about is like their whole sphere. It's like they're on a different planet.
Well, it's designed to manage the slaves.
Yeah, well, ultimately, yes, they don't talk about that, but,
no,
but
of course
the...
Not.
Control and monitoring of the enemy is what the objective is, but they never talk about the other side of that, which is control and monitoring of us.
You know what I like? I like listening to Council on Foreign Relations sessions where they completely, repeatedly remind everyone, now this meeting is on the record. Have you noticed
yeah.
that?
Yes.
I just want to remind everybody, this meeting is on the record.
Yeah, so be careful what you say.
Be careful what you say, lest the slaves find out. Incredible. Anyway, they had in attendance Joseph Dunford, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the moderator was the Andrea Mitchell, the NBC News correspondent, and, of course, the wife of former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Another conflict of interest, because is she going to report anything legitimate when she's compromised in this corrupt system? I don't think so. Anyway, they're talking about the greatest threat that we face.
When I answered that question in my confirmation hearing, someone asked, what is the greatest threat we face? And I said at the time, you know, from a state actor perspective, it's Russia. And I said that because of their nuclear capability, their cyber capabilities, what they had done in Georgia, what they had done in Crimea, and what was ongoing in Ukraine at the time and remains ongoing. But I would quickly add that we don't actually have the luxury today of singling out one challenge. So I think from an aggregate capacity and capability perspective, Russia is the most capable state actor that we face. But we have challenges. Obviously, North Korea today, from a sense of urgency perspective, would be our number one challenge. We're certainly dealing with malign influence from Iran on a daily basis. Clearly, the fight against violent extremism is one that we're completely engaged with. And we have some security challenges in the Pacific with a rising China as well. So, again, we don't have, if I were to say, I just want to put it in context, if I were to say Russia is the greatest threat, it is one of the threats that we face right now and the one that is the most militarily capable.
Now, he referenced what the Russians did in Georgia and Ukraine. First, the attack by the Russians against Georgia was in retaliation for the Georgian government's military attack on South Ossetia, one of two regions that broke away from Georgia and declared their independence. Now, the other region was Abkhazia. Now, Georgia is a strategic point. It just happens to be that it's a strategic point for oil and gas in the Caspian Sea. And as a result, of course, the United States had military heavily involved there. Russia couldn't have a war brewing on their border. And so they got involved. As far as Ukraine is concerned, the people of Crimea overwhelmingly voted in favor of seceding from Ukraine and becoming a part of Russia in a referendum that was held there. So this notion, this idea that, it's just all Russian aggression. They forcefully annexed Crimea against its will. It's a work of fiction by the State Department and the U.S. military. And of course, you got the Kagans involved, I'm sure, as what's-her-face, Mr. or Ms. $5 billion we spent in Ukraine.
Pritzker?
No, the former State Department, her name is escaping me at the moment. But anyway, this is all a neocon construct, is my point. Now, the next clip is an interesting reaction. She asked him a question about whether Russia knew about Syria's use of chemical weapons ahead of time. Now, we know that all these lies have been told about Syria, just like lies were told about Saddam Hussein, you know, gassing the Kurds and, you know, using these types of weapons on his own people. Now, Syria really used chemical weapons, as the State Department military claim. Seems to me like Joseph Dunford would be able to just answer the question. But he doesn't do that.
Do you believe that Russia knew that Assad was going to deploy chemical weapons back in April?
Andrea, I really can't comment on that.
Because we don't know, or because it's...
It'd be something I wouldn't want to comment on.
How has...
Do I have to?
No.
Now, isn't that interesting? And they're yucking it up and thinking it's all funny and everything. But why wouldn't he just say, I don't know? Or why the stonewalling? Why the obfuscation? That's a hard word to say.
Well, he answered the question by not answering the question.
Well, he sidestepped the issue, mm-hmm. which makes me think, why would he do that, except that he's going to have to talk out of his hind end and start making stuff up about what Russia knew, when Russia knew it, how they knew it, which later on could end up biting him in the hind end. So he's just not going to go into it. He's going to avoid the matter altogether. It's clear these people are lying, 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 because they're desperate, desperate to get this war started.
You know what? There's a lot that goes on over there under the guise of human rights, because if you boil it all down, you can't use chemical weapons because it's a violation of human rights. You know, and it's human rights is one of the main underlying themes of the United Nations. And so, since they're trying to build this one world international governing system, everything is a violation of human rights. That's why in this country the left calls everybody a racist, xenophobe, because using those terms, it says that you're violating somebody's human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well,
you know, that's the dividing line, you know, it's the human rights deal.
Yeah. Well, they go on to talk about North Korea, and he describes just how awful a conflict on the Korean Peninsula would be. Of course, that isn't going to stop them from starting one, but I thought it was interesting to hear the Joint Chiefs of Staff describe just how bad this would be.
We're involved right now in what's called a pressurization campaign, primarily using diplomatic and economic pressure to denuclearize North Korea, the Korean Peninsula. And what Secretary Tillerson is attempting to do is get the entire international community to tighten the noose, if you will, for trade and economically cause North Korea to at least initially freeze and cap their capability, and then eventually to denuclearize. We are all, trying to support Secretary Tillerson in that regard, and the U.S. military is completely supportive with the military dimension of deterring North Korea today and making sure that everything we do is consistent with his effort to diplomatically and economically resolve the issue. Many people, and this is an important point, many people have talked about military options as with words like unimaginable. And I would probably shift that slightly and say, it would be horrific, and there would be a loss of life unlike any we have experienced in our lifetimes. And I mean, anyone who's been alive since World War II has never seen the loss of life that could occur if there's a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But as I've told my counterparts, both friend and foe, it is not unimaginable to have military options to respond to North Korean nuclear capability. What's unimaginable to me is allowing a capability that will allow a nuclear weapon to land in Denver, Colorado. That's unimaginable to me. And so my job will be to develop military options to make sure that doesn't happen. Again, the primary task is to support Secretary Tillerson right now, and ideally we will denuclearize the North Korean, the Korean Peninsula with economic and political means. But in the meantime, I can assure the American people that our job is to develop military options in the event that that fails and be prepared to mitigate some of the consequences that have been well covered in the media.
What do you think of that?
I'm floored by the stupidity of it. It's like stepping back into the 1960s, I swear, you know? Mm-hmm. The missiles over in Cuba and all the talk about missiles coming from the Soviet Union that are going to arrive on our shores. It's like we didn't learn anything over 40 years. We didn't have scientists working. We didn't have, in 1946, the development of a computer system that could calculate the trajectory of a missile. 1946 is when that was. And so today, oh, we're working on it because we're so afraid that North Korea, this tiny little nothing island, is going to shoot a missile over here and just destroy everything. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
Yeah, exactly. I got a couple more clips from this steering, but we don't have time before the break. Let me go ahead and take the call. Just call on the line. Hello, Florida. Come on in.
Yes. Hi, Darren. Hello, Vicki. This is Harvey in Florida.
Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Harvey.
The sound of that laughter at the Aspen Institute. Could you play just that last part of it again, Darren, where they're laughing at this scumbag?
Let me see. I don't know which clip it is. Let's see.
But that was enough to really give me the willy. That tells you what these people think is real funny. And the great, I wonder, you mentioned Rumsfeld earlier today. Where was Rummy? Was Rummy at the conference? You think the Rumsfeld was there? Speaking of scumbags?
I don't think so. I didn't see him in the list of conferences, but I know Darren is going to put the link to the forum. And there are about nine or ten videos that are about an hour long each.
There are several, yes. Tell you what, we're at the top of the hour. I'll hold you over, Harvey. Hang on just a minute. And we'll continue with the other sound bites that we have. Stay with us, folks. Covered America continues. Hour number three is straight ahead.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5. This is the third and final hour of Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Vicki Davis is here, and we have Harvey in Florida on the line. And your phone calls are welcome as well. 844-646-8376. Toll free, 844-6-GOVERN. As we move along here, we've got a lot of other things to cover, though, in this hour as well. But we also like to hear from our listeners as well. Anyway, Harvey, did you have anything else?
Oh, absolutely. I'll take a few minutes, but... this conference, if there was a God in heaven and or a space alien, I wish they would take care of that, and that would get rid of a big problem if they landed in the Aspen Institute there and took care of it. These are some of the worst human creatures I've ever heard in my life, including Andrea Mitchell, who's basically in on it. It's unbelievable what you present on your program.
Yeah, and I have Vicki to thank for pointing out the Aspen Institute conference. But you could go through and literally spend a lifetime listening to all the different think tanks and the different congressional hearings by these brilliant minds that just never cease to come up with solutions for all of us.
Yeah, they never get any fresh blood. It's like they an incestuous group that lives in that Washington, D.C. corridor area, and they are trying to solve problems that they created, you know, as far back as World War II, and actually probably farther, but primarily from World War II. And so they're still working on plans that were formulated just right before the end of the war and after the end of the war. And you know what? I realized that the whole creation of the United Nations started with a conference that FDR had with Winston Churchill when they signed the Atlantic Charter. This was before the United States got into the war. And I realized that what Winston Churchill got FDR to do was to get the United States to be the bodyguard for the British Empire and mercantilism. Because the British Empire had not split off, you know, to create the Commonwealth of Nations at that point. It was still the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And so what the Atlantic Charter is, from my point of view, it's an agreement to be the bodyguard for the British Empire.
Yeah, I can't say you're wrong. It's obvious that we're going right along. I mean, we played the audio from that, what was it, the head of the security, the military head from Britain back, what was it, last week or the week before? Where he's talking about how it's all coming together again. We're being merged with Britain. The British, our military is being merged with them. They're developing joint systems. And so, yeah, everything is being commanded in a joint way. And that's why people who are signing up for the military today need to keep in mind, you're not fighting for your country. You think you're fighting for your country. You think you're doing the patriotic thing. But you're fighting for the world order, as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. put it in Foreign Affairs some years ago. In defense of the world order, U.S. soldiers will have to kill and die. We're not going to have a world order without paying for it first in blood and in money.
Right.
But of course, it won't be his or his children or grandchildren. No. That's for you to do.
And the organization of the world order is in line with the system in the City of London. It's not a governing system per se. It is a system of organizations, of nonprofits, mm-hmm. and the privatization of government fits right in with that. You know, you only have governing with a few people at the very top of the pyramid. They're the ones that make decisions for everybody else. So it is a one-world totalitarian system. And all of these nonprofit organizations, NGOs, and all of that, they basically just carry out the orders. They carry back the global decisions into your country.
Mm-hmm.
So they are like an infection. They are like a disease.
Yep.
Only it's a disease that causes other diseases because there is no coordination of effort amongst these NGOs. And so organizationally, as a system, it can't work. Because you have some organizations working at cross purposes of other organizations.
Yep, exactly. Harvey, do you have anything else?
Well, one or two other things. You're exactly right, Vicki. This is an organization that means the death of all mankind. And Rumsfeld did and other companies, Rumsfeld and the other companies, did sell the equipment to North Korea, so they created the problem, just as you said, Darren. But, you know, I think it was the great Ronald Reagan, phony, worthless, because he really wasn't the president, it was George Bush, George Bush Sr., and didn't he go off on a tangent? Star Wars. We're going to be knocking everything out of the sky with our laser beams from outer space, like we used possibly on 9/11 2001 to take down the Twin Towers and turn them to dust. So, isn't this all about breaking out their Star Wars component? What do you think about that, Vicki?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
Star Wars.
Oh, the Star Wars?
Yeah, I think the great Reagan was working on Star Wars 30 years ago, and we're going to have satellites that could beam down and knock out anything that could possibly penetrate us.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, you're exactly right. But that was a lot of virtual reality, too. They were working on the computer systems for a lot of things, but... I think mostly that was about building information systems and technology for societal control, more than it was about, you know, building a satellite safety net.
Well, I still have to come back to the fact that we have this apparent surveillance satellite orbiting around over the U.S., making passes every day. And if they really had the technology, why don't they shoot down, you know, why don't they destroy that satellite? Seems like they could at least EMP it, you know, fry the circuitry or something. But yeah.
That's always the way it is. They present the problem, but they never take the obvious solution, which, if you pay attention to other things besides that one thing, you know that there is an obvious solution, you know, and if there isn't, then they're lying over here, you know. So that's what I mean when I say none of this makes sense logically if you examine it.
Yeah. Well,
You played a tape of Dunford saying how he's putting North Korea in a pressure tank. Mm-hmm. And they're putting a lot of pressure financially and militarily, and they're pressuring, putting a little pressure container around him so they could denuclearize him.
Right.
Well, didn't we denuclearize Gaddafi in Libya, and he gave up all his nuclear weapons right before he was, maybe a few years, a year or two before he was murdered by Hillary Clinton and her friends?
Well, and the same thing.
Yeah, good point.
And the same thing with, exactly. And the same thing with Saddam Hussein. Same deal. Yeah,
yep,
with Gaddafi.
Yep.
We came, we saw, he died.
And don't think that Kim Jong-un...
And she's never been locked up for that. She's never been arrested or tried or anything.
Of course not.
She's still walking around free, that creature.
Will she run against Donald Trump in 2020?
Unbelievable. You couldn't make this up, Darren. Thank you so much for your wonderful program. Keep up the wonderful work, you and Vicki.
Hey,
thank you so much.
Thanks
for letting me talk.
Yep, God bless you, sir. We'll talk later. There he is, Harvey in Florida. Yeah, I mean, don't think that Kim Jong-un doesn't know about that and hasn't followed that, and that is not... I mean, that is exactly what's playing into this whole equation right now. He'd be a fool to give up his nuclear weapons. And see, these people at this Aspen think tank, they know this. Now, this Joseph Dunford, getting back to this, he says if diplomacy fails, the military option will kick in. But you know, why should diplomacy work? You know, when again, just like we were just talking about, Saddam Hussein was... He gave in to diplomacy. Gaddafi, diplomacy. All these countries that gave in to diplomacy, and then later on, they still are overthrown.
James Clapper said here the other day that having been there in 2014, he's convinced that Kim Jong-un would never give up his nukes.
It's the lesson of Gaddafi.
No, look, I think that that has certainly been conventional wisdom. When Secretary Tillerson came in, and the intelligence community's, you know, general assessment was, and it's been public, that Kim Jong-un views his existence as inextricably linked to nuclear weapons, and China will never cooperate. So those are the two things that everybody has basically said. That's conventional wisdom in North Korea. So where does that leave us? Leaves us, what, to a military option. We've already talked about the consequences of that. Secretary Tillerson said he didn't believe, number one, that economic sanctions had ever been fully implemented with the full support of China, and so he was going to do that. And I think he also believed that over time, North Korea was becoming more of a liability to China than an asset. And we've seen that. We've seen blatant disrespect by North Korea. For example, last year when China hosted the G20, North Korea conducted a missile test in the midst of the G20, which was an insult to the Chinese regime. So I think for all of us, we should give Secretary Tillerson full support in attempting to resolve this diplomatically and economically, even as we recognize that it may not happen. And there may have to be a follow-up option, which is the military option. But we can wring our hands and say it'll never happen, or we can roll up our sleeves and make an effort to have a concerted economic and diplomatic plan that does cause KJU, Kim Jong-un, to come to the table and begin to have a conversation, at least stop the path that he's on right now, which is further development of intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear capability. And to me, it makes all the sense in the world to prove the theory of the case and to work this for a few more months.
The CIA director, Pompeo, said, or he seemed to suggest or hint at this forum the other day, that regime change, taking Kim Jong-un out, was an option.
Yeah, that, at the end of the day, you know, that's a policy option, right? So that wouldn't be something I would comment on as a military leader.
So, a coup attempt.
They are just unbelievable.
Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, I think the last real diplomat that the United States had died when Richard Holbrooke died. We don't have diplomats. We have people that come from corporations, and they behave as corporate leaders, which means they're autocratic and dictatorial and
satanic comes to mind.
Yeah, and you can't negotiate with somebody that you're trying to scare. You know, that's not negotiations.
Well,
that's,
you can make them
intimidation.
An offer they can't refuse. You mean that's
right.
That's not negotiation? The mob does it all the time.
Yeah. Well, and that's becoming the modus operandi of the United
that
States.
That is our foreign policy.
Yeah, that's foreign policy.
That's our foreign policy.
Actually, that's our domestic policy, too.
That's true, increasingly, yes. Mm-hmm. They then threw it to the audience questions, and what I believe is a planted question in the audience, even though they tried to pass it off like it wasn't, because it was all too convenient.
Could you address the impact of what I'll call the budget drama over the last 6 years and the impact on our capabilities and future capabilities through modernization and what your prognosis is for the future of that? Yeah.
Alan's an old friend, at least he used to be. I thought, you know, it was close. I thought,
hey, almost got out
I might, almost, I might get out of here without having to talk about the, I mean, I'm in Colorado, I'm feeling pretty good, the weather's out here.
Like he doesn't want to talk about the budget and their funding, come on.
And you just dragged me right back down. On a more serious note, and this is a serious note, in about 2000, 2001, you know, I could have looked at you and said that we have a decisive competitive advantage in the U.S. military over any potential adversary. And I could have said that with full confidence. I'm equally confident in telling you today that that competitive advantage has eroded over time. And that's the biggest, that's the most insidious effect of the budget challenges, is that our competitive advantage has eroded. Now you say, well, you're spending $600 billion. How could our competitive advantage erode? We have each year prioritized current operations and all the things that we're dealing with, and because we had to make tough choices in the year of execution, where there's very little flexibility, for those of you in business, there's very little flexibility when you're in a year of execution, where do we go continuously? Future capability development, innovation, science and technology. So here we are now, 7 years into a very myopic, short-sighted view, and our competitive advantage has eroded. And as a result, in, you know, Pentagon terms, try not to use the words we used back there, but we call it a bow wave. There's a bow wave of modernization requirements. In other words, we typically modernize the force over the course of decades. There's now major programs that have all come together into obsolescence at the same time. And so it's exacerbated the challenge we already have. Not only did we go 7 years without proper focus on the future, we are now at a point where the modernization that we should have been doing over the course of 20 years will now come due over the next 5 to 7 years at a time when our operational tempo and commitments around the world are very high. So this is serious. This is serious. And for me, I'm going to be in my job either 2 more months or 2 more years. And or 2 more weeks, but it's not going to be long. But on a serious note, by 2021, 2022, 2023, if we don't reverse this trend, whoever's sitting in my seat will not be able to say that the United States of America has a competitive advantage. What does that mean? We don't have an effective nuclear deterrent. We don't have an effective conventional deterrent. The prospects of conflict increase. We aren't able to, on a day-to-day basis, assure our allies and partners that have made us so strong since World War II that the United States of America can meet its alliance commitments. So it's not only about the physical, but it's also about the psychological effect of that degradation of capability over time. So, Alan, this last 7 years, I could not overestimate the impact that it's had, nor could I overestimate the need for us now to recognize that the world we're in right now, you know, to quote Kissinger, for those of you who heard him say it, is as complex and as volatile as any period since World War II. This is not the time for a period of weakness.
Like, come on, man. Get with the program.
There you go. Show me the money, honey. Despite a $600 billion annual budget, the military needs more.
Yeah, more than the rest of the world put together.
Yeah.
The thing, I do believe that the around the year 2000, the military did have budgetary problems because the plan was to disarm the military. And so the whole peace dividend that Clinton talked about, that came from the military budget, and they used that money. They tried to convert the military to domestic, convert the military defense contracting to peaceful purposes, domestic purposes. But an interesting thing I heard about a week ago or 2 weeks ago, Trump's administration is like a replay of the beginning of the George W. Bush administration. And around in 2004, there were hearings on the Congressional Budget Office and how they project the amount of money that Congress will have to spend. Well, as it was described, it was classic accounting fraud. You know, they from where they were, they projected 3 years of history because they didn't have actual statistics on tax revenues. So for 2004, the actual tax revenues that they were working on were from 2001. So they had to project history and then project forward based on old data. Well, you know, that's classic accounting fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I heard that they're going to get rid of the Congressional Budget Office, fire, I don't know, about 87 people that work in the Congressional Budget Office, and they're going to privatize it.
Well,
they're going to take the figures from various think tanks and, you know, put them together and kind of come up with a synthesis of how much money the government will have to spend in the next 10 years.
What do we need a budget for anyway? Why have a budget?
Well, we don't, since they can print amount of money, whatever money they want, which is what they did.
Whenever we reach the ceiling, we just raise our debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this fun?
Yeah, and then they sell our debt to foreign countries like communist China and Russia and Italy and, you know, all around the world. And then the way that those countries, then what they do with those dollars is they're coming into our country and they're buying it up.
Yeah, which is why the price of real estate is going nuts everywhere.
Yeah.
To the point where... All right.
And the whole economic development planning, which started in the 1960s, but which has accelerated, you know, because of the foreign direct investment or whatever, what they're actually doing is they are creating debt.
Mm-hmm.
Debt that can be sold.
Yeah, I've got a diversion. As far as real estate is concerned, let me just go ahead and play this real quick.
Hundreds of Facebook cafeteria workers are unionizing. More than 500 food workers at the company's headquarters in Menlo Park, California, are pushing for higher wages and more affordable health benefits. The union says these workers are struggling to afford the rising cost of living in that area. And there's a story of one family who lives in a garage and others who commute from far distances. Contract workers like janitors, shuttle bus drivers, and security guards from other major Silicon Valley firms have also moved to unionize.
So we already talked before about how some Google employees are literally living on the campus in RVs and trailers because everything they need is on the campus inside. They have recreation, they have showers, they have food, cafeterias, and what have you. And so there's really no need to leave. So they just stay outside and sleep outside in the parking lot and go in. Talk about a company store slaves. Everything's reverting right back to where it once was. It's remarkable.
And they will be slaves. They are
slaves.
In an economic zone. Which is part of the global system as they disintegrate our government. The idea is to have, you could call it a technology center, but it's really more of a economic center, an economic core of an area. Used to be called cities, but the idea is that with the partnership of the business leaders, the largest businesses partnered with the mayors of the area, and they have their own media operations. You have a nice little syndicate to control a zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's by design. I mean, that's an intentional design for the new order of the world.
Yeah. I want to come back to the budget of the military for just a minute. $600 billion a year. We can't fathom that. We can't wrap our brain around that unbelievable amount of money. And yet, what are we getting for our money? I did some calculating last night. The War on Terror officially began with Operation Enduring Freedom back in 2001. It was launched in Afghanistan. The exact date was October 7th, 2001. As of today, that was 5,774 days ago, or 15 years, 9 months, and 22 days. There's been untold numbers of casualties and injuries, both physically and mentally, on all sides of the conflict. And what have we got to show for it? I mean, of course, we got corporations like Raytheon and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Halliburton and others that have done very well. Defense contractors have made out pretty good. But what about the country? Are we any safer? Is the threat of terrorism any less pronounced or blatant than it was just 5,774 days ago? You know, we just did that story. I just shared that piece about the supermarket in Hamburg where guy goes on and yells Allahu Akbar and knifes people. But we're constantly hearing our officials talk about how homegrown terrorism is a problem and how we have to engage in all of these different mechanisms of control. The NSA has to listen in on all of our conversations. The FBI has got to have back doors to our encryption and break into our encryption because it's all being done to keep you safe.
Yeah.
One area.
Well, and that's the fallacy of all of this is that these technologies that they're implementing all over our country, if you're in economic trouble, you know, what you do in your household is you say, okay, what can I live without? And I don't care what they say. We don't need an Internet of Things. We don't need a smart grid. All of this technology that they're developing for the, quote, future, if we are as in as much economic trouble as what they say we are, to the point where they're, you know, cutting Medicaid, cutting Medicare, they'd like to eliminate Social Security. Remember 2004 when they tried to privatize Social Security?
Mm-hmm.
You know, put your Social Security money in an account so that the Wall Street bankster gangsters could steal it.
They've been eyeing retirement.
Right. So they destroy our economy by exporting, deindustrializing the economy. So the only economy we have is intellectual information systems. They then say they want to eliminate all of these social safety net programs at the same time that they want to build all this technology that we really don't need and that is to the detriment of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at all of these things together, the only conclusion is that there is insanity in Washington, D.C., and that I really do believe it.
Yeah. Got a phone call on the line. Let's go ahead and take this call real quick. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Hey, Darren. Sam calling. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Hope you're all doing well over there. Hello to you too, Vicky. I want to do some cleanup on the back end on this issue Ron had called in about, because we were talking about those, you know, all this surveillance stuff a little bit earlier in the show.
Right.
And we were out, so I couldn't call you at the time. But the company that is selling these phones, and apparently they're using distributors to do it, is a company called Clarity Products, and the website is clarityproducts.com. And what the deal is here, kind of as Ron was trying to explain to you, is you have on this particular phone they're trying to sell them on, you have a you have the phone line, and then you have the Ethernet cable. And they, by the way, they supposedly these phones can work on either voice over IP or regular phone service. And this is where I see a dangerous precedent as we move more into voice over IP, because eventually everything is going to go through that cable. And you buy a voice over IP phone that's equipped with all this stuff, how much is going to be voice over IP and how much is going to be the rest of the surveillance grid going through that Ethernet cable? But anyway, these phones do exactly that. They you speak into the phone, the data is sent off to a server, which is reinterpreted as English and then is sent back to you. And when you it shows up, what you said then shows up on your display, which I'm not sure why you would need that. But when I was reading around up there on their site, they said a division of Plantronics funded by the U.S. government. So what does that tell you?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because it reminded me.
I'm here to help.
Sorry.
This whole FirstNet system, the build-out of the 5G network supposedly for the 911 system, what it really is for, the underlying reason, is so that they can have telemedicine.
Yeah.
You know, they need that kind of bandwidth so that the doctors, the remote doctors, the doctor that you have that's going to be, you know, stuck in India or Africa or somewhere like that, we'll be able to see you clearly, and theoretically, we'll be able to diagnose you from being able to look at you, look at your problem or whatever, or just talk to you.
Yeah.
So that's the underlying reason that they're not talking about too much, you know, is for the global health system, that the medical part of it, they need to have the really high bandwidth.
Well, you know, another thing is speech recognition.
Go ahead, Darren.
Speech to text is something that's really a fairly new technology. And now it seems like I heard somebody from the other day talking about how Skype now uses speech to text, and there are these people were talking about how everything they said was being transcribed in Skype, and now I could see how that would be useful for somebody who had a problem with maybe, you know, a hearing impaired individual, but if it's typing out everything you say, I don't know. It, to me, would be very easy for Microsoft or somebody to order somebody outside of maybe inside the government, for instance, to order a transcript. Or, you know, it would be easy for a transcript to at least be made, if it was needed, of your entire conversation.
Sure.
Another thing I've noticed here, And I haven't seen the actual typing out. Maybe I don't have the right version, or maybe it's not supported on the platform on which I'm using Skype. But I will tell you, I've seen a number of times when I've had, commercial breaks, or I have music playing, bumper music. It often pops up with this little thing in the window, in the corner, that tells me I've got noise going out. You've got a lot of background noise. Well, what do I care? As long as the other party doesn't care about the noise. But see, their system cares about the noise. Because because
they can't get it clear.
They can't understand what's being said, if something is being said. So eliminate the noise so we can type out what you're saying. I don't know. I know it's conspiracy theory because I can't prove it. But it just makes me feel like maybe they're producing transcripts.
Well, I take everything in the totality of the situation, and so it's really not conspiracy theory. I mean, if you can think of a purpose for them to do it, then they're probably doing it.
Well, court
because
records.
nothing is benign. Nothing about this whole technocratic system that they're installing, none of it is benign.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think it is, then you're Pollyanna living in La La Land.
Yeah.
Well, see, I'm fighting this now, and I've got one of my machines that I use for production work that it's on my network, but it never sees the internet. It's blocked from the net, and the reason that it is because you get problems with things like Apple's iTunes screwing up your library of audio files and stuff by putting names to files that aren't even the real names of the files. I've had a lot of trouble with this. So I took this machine offline to keep that from happening. Well, ever since then, now, whenever I go to quit out of iTunes, because iTunes is the main player for anything you want to play on your Mac. I mean, there are other players out there, but iTunes is the main audio player. They want you to play everything on books and everything else. Well, when you try to quit out of iTunes and it's not seeing an internet connection, it'll hang for about 2 or 3 minutes. It will not quit. It'll just sit there and hang like it's trying to send something to Apple, but it can't do it because now if I have a net connection, then it doesn't hang anymore. It'll just go ahead and quit when I hit the quit command just like it's supposed to. So the question I'm trying to figure out is, what in the hell is it sending off to Apple when I go to quit out of the program? Is it sending, you know, statistical data on how my usage of the program, how long I used it, what I played? Even though I have all that stuff shut off, you know, like library sharing and all that kind of stuff, there's still something that it wants to send out.
Phoning home.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's the problem I have with Windows 10, which is why I don't have any plans to ever go to Windows 10. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
There's a few more years of support for life on Windows 7. So I'm going to stay with that for as long as I can. And then after that, I guess it's going to be Linux of some sort. Because
And I know more and more people that are doing it. And the blind, by the way, are among the worst at trying to get to understand the problems with this technology. I can't tell you how many times most of the blind people that I know, you talk to them about this stuff, they just do not give a rat's behind. They love the technology, and they just love it. They love to swim in it. Yeah. And their freedom, their perceived freedom, is winding up to be their absolute slavery.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a special problem.
Yeah.
Because it does give them a certain amount of independence, whereas they have none without it.
Well, it's just like self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles. That would tremendously benefit the blind.
True. Yeah.
But you don't
design your society around what benefits the few.
Well, you can, as long as it's not for a greater purpose of control. I mean, I'm all for accommodating, you know, everybody. But the problem there is we know this is not about accommodation.
Right. Well, yeah, it's the cost-benefit analysis things. If you enslave 95% of the world to give freedom to 5%, that's not a good trade-off.
Well, and it's not real freedom. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's perceived freedom on the front end, but it's in slavery. You're being enslaved on the back end because of all the data they're collecting on you. And as this surveillance grid becomes more invasive, we're going to see more and more stuff used on these technologies on a day-to-day basis. I mean, we know, it's documented that we know that insurance companies want all this stuff to be able to tailor your insurance policy to what they want you to have. In other words, if they can track what you're eating, if they can track what you're doing, you know, how you live your life throughout the day, and more and more stuff, you know, through the Internet of Things, this is how they're going to do it. So they'll have a complete profile on you, and you won't even know what data you're giving out, because it's all these applications that phone home at different times when you don't know it. I mean, the only way you can get any kind of an accurate idea, at least on the Mac, and I don't know if Windows has this or not, but there's a little program out there that can be installed in your menu bar on a Mac called Little Snitch. And what Little Snitch does is it keeps a log for you to view of what every application is sending out to whomever on the net. Now, I mean, the name Little Snitch kind of sounds kind of ominous in itself, but you know,
it's
the whole
snitching
idea,
on the snitchers.
Program.
Yeah, I wish I had one of those. I'd have it up all the time.
Yeah, Windows. Well, it sounds like a packet sniffer, only it's a logger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people that know what's going on, you know, I read on some of the forums where a lot of people are putting this on their machines, and that's how they're able to find out what the operating system is sending off and what various programs are sending off to Apple and various other vendors, because that program logs everything that goes out through the TCP/IP connection. So
there you go.
There's at least something on that side. And that's all I got, guys. I'll let you have the rest of it.
I appreciate it, Sam. Talk to you later.
Yep.
There he is, Sam in Missouri. All right, I'll tell you what. Earlier I was talking about the budget and the fact that we spend $600 billion, and what are we getting for our money? You know, and another area that has really benefited is the intelligence establishment. Now, another hearing that we had, it was actually a forum, was the Capitol Hill National Security Forum, where Nicholas Rasmussen of the National Counterterrorism Center was asked by the moderator, which was Fox News' Catherine Herridge, about the terror plots that the U.S. intelligence has disrupted recently. Okay? She's asking them this question. What kind of plots have been disrupted recently? And listen to what he had to say.
Nick, you suggested in your earlier statement that we have disrupted significant plots targeting the homeland. Is that correct?
Yes, and I'm talking about kind of a sweep of a long period of history in the period since 9/11.
So. Okay, but let's talk about recently. Have we disrupted major plots targeting the U.S. in the last year?
I don't know that I would say something with that degree of specificity. We are constantly looking to identify individuals who may have designs on the homeland, but I don't think I'd put anything into the category in just the same way you put it.
Oops. In other words, zilch, nada, nothing. There hasn't been anything real. Now, we can't let that stand, Vicky.
No.
So immediately, Representative Will Hurd rushes in to save the day.
Okay. A lot of Americans...
But I would say we've stopped people that were capable of planning and plotting a major attack on the U.S., right? You know, you have to know when you take key people off the battlefield that have the capabilities and the leadership abilities to do some of these things, that counts. And there have been a number of those significant activities over the last year.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I was just trying to kind of carefully parse the idea. I didn't want to leave the impression that necessarily there was some incipient imminent plot aimed at the homeland that kind of just came close to happening, because I think that would be misleading.
Shh, your budget's going to be cut. Anyway, Rasmussen continues by talking about resilient communities.
I want to pick up on something else that Congressman Hurd said, and that is that, you know, the different array of things we can do to defend ourselves includes all of the things that the congressman mentioned. But I think one of the things that's underplayed in this discussion, particularly in a homeland context, is just an effort to create a greater sense of societal resilience, a sense that we will cope, not just cope, but prosper and bounce back and succeed in living our lives regardless of what happens on any given day.
Okay, now listen to what he says here. This is very interesting.
I would agree with Hank Crumpton that, unfortunately, some form of terrorism will be a semi-permanent feature of the landscape, whether it's this ideology or some future ideology. And so the answer is to continue to hone our law enforcement and intelligence capabilities and to bring the hammer down when the hammer needs to be brought down. But a big part of the answer is also giving communities around this country the tools they need to protect themselves, the information they need to protect themselves, and an understanding of the terrorist threat so that they can understand how to put that terrorist threat in perspective as a raid against all of the other things to worry about on a given day.
So in other words, he's saying that terrorism is here to stay, despite the trillions and trillions we've already spent on the military, security, and intelligence industries. We're always going to be at war.
Perpetual war.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes,
Oceana,
that's exactly
sip your victory coffee, comrades.
Yeah. And we're just going to buck up and keep on going.
That's right.
You know, when they blow up your kids at the school or, you know, a guy goes crazy at the shopping mall, we're just going to buck up and keep on rolling.
That's the spirit.
Oh, my God. See, now, that is a perfect example of insanity.
Yes. Yes.
We don't have to have terrorists in our midst. Let's stop importing them.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and move on. Oops, sorry.
That's
this is
not
the, wrong
the
one. Let me go to this one.
I just wanted to point out how hard this is.
By the way, this is Jane Harmon. She's the president and CEO of the Wilson International Center, the Wilson International Center for Scholars. And she and her globalist conspirators want to take society in a certain direction, and she does a slip here and tells us exactly where that wants
to be. I just wanted to point out how hard this is and to salute the intelligence community for what it is able to do. It will never be 100% effective. I mean, now we have learned that the new tools of terror are a big truck and a butcher knife. And even if we have gun control in this, more gun control in this country, there's still going to be people with validly licensed guns who go crazy and do dumb stuff and kill people.
Even if we have gun control, I mean more gun control. So obviously, that's where they're wanting to take this.
So That's not the catastrophic threat that you were asking about, Catherine, but I don't rule that out either. I mean, there are biological weapons that are pretty easily accessible in hospitals. But the other point I wanted to make is resilience matters. Yes, it does. Think Britain. Keep calm and carry on. They've had more attacks lately than any place.
Keep calm and carry on. There's a show title for you.
Also are things we can
do. I've
seen
statistics that the native Britain population is going to be gone in about 40 years. It's all going to be Muslims. I mean, they're taking it over.
Yeah, by design. By design. Mm-hmm.
Keep calm and carry on. They've had more attacks lately than any place. But there also are things we can do to win the argument. You said that this is an idea. And yes, having pumps and wingtips is a way to win the argument using diplomacy. But there are better arguments against the arguments that recruit child brides to go get their swimming pool in Afghanistan or wherever it is, Yemen, someplace that Peter and I have been. I actually went to Yemen. I don't think you did.
Okay.
Oh, you did. Okay. Everything he could do to keep up with me, he actually did. But so, how do we win the argument? We live our values. That's a very important part of it. A lot of people want to live here because of our values. We also do effective counter-messaging that we need to work on more. When John Kelly was talking earlier, I think most of you were here, he was talking about the response part, and he was talking about the private sector intercepting bad messages. But the private sector is also capable of, in near simultaneous time, putting on good messages and having those who have escaped from the horror of ISIS, or those who are respected imams, or those who are respected community figures, come up in the same space that some kid is looking at and say, you know, wait a minute, here is an alternate idea, and having communities give these kids opportunities, these lost kids who are susceptible to the messages. So I think there are some tools we need to invest in more.
Jobs for jihadis?
And the ultimate big brother, when you're on the wrong screen that they don't want you to be on, big brother's going to pop up and say, oh, no, you should go here rather than here.
She's talking about propaganda.
Of course. Yes. Yes. And people in the future using computers will live in a world of propaganda. They will not have their own thoughts because their thoughts will be given to them with neuro-linguistic programming, with navigation control, you know, on their searches, all kinds of things. They might not understand that they're being steered, but they will be totally steered and controlled.
Yeah. Now, back to the Aspen Institute. They had a panel discussion on the subject of security versus liberty. On the panel was Monica Bickert, who is head of the product policy and counterterrorism at Facebook. There is also Dana Bowente. He is the acting assistant attorney general for national security. There was Walter Isaacson. He is from the Aspen Institute, president and CEO. And then the moderator was Ellen Nashkashima, national security writer for the Washington Post. And after a fair amount of Trump bashing, as you could imagine, in this conference, Monica Bickert of Facebook, she's the first one to answer a question, and she makes the point we've made here several times. The subject was weakening encryption, and she talks about how weakening encryption or providing for the authorities a way to break it or get into it would also, by extension, weaken it for bad actors.
So let's move to the debate about security or liberty versus security. More in recent years, especially when it comes to the debate over encryption, which we talked about a little while ago this morning, we started to hear people reframe it from privacy versus security to security versus security. Or in other words, cybersecurity and the ability to thwart, say, a hacker versus national security and the ability to detect and thwart a terrorist. So the technologist Bruce Schneier argues, and I quote, "Data security is essential for all national security in the 21st century. We whereas being able to eavesdrop on communications is a possibly useful, nice-to-have investigative tool. Do you agree with his argument, Monica, and his reframing of the debate?
Well, I think, you know, the issue really is how do we best keep people safe? And that does take different forms. It does mean keeping people safe from their data being hacked and shared, their identity being stolen. Mm-hmm. It also means keeping people safe from threats of violence online and making sure that if somebody's, say, planning a terror attack, that we're best positioned to try to find that and try to get it to the appropriate authorities. I wouldn't necessarily frame it in exactly the same way. I spent more than 10 years as a prosecutor, mm-hmm. and I had cases where, child safety cases, child pornography cases, where we could not access content, and the content might have been very relevant to our case. So I don't think it's as easy as saying that this never matters, that content never matters, but at the same time, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that you cannot create an access point, a vulnerability in encryption for the good purpose of responding to valid legal process with content without also weakening a system so that bad actors, malicious actors, can exploit that vulnerability. That's something that is fundamental to the encryption debate that I think we have to be aware of.
Fundamental, and I agree. I agree completely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just glad to see somebody on one of these panels actually come out and say this. Now, Dana Boente... again, he's the Assistant Attorney General for National Security. The moderator turned her attention to him. He's claiming, we don't really want back doors and encryption. No. We just want, maybe a front door?
Well, maybe we should back up for a minute here and sort of just lay the terms for the encryption debate and talk a little bit about what types of encryption there are, because we have data at rest on devices, on your iPhone, your pictures, your text messages that are stored there, which was a type of data that the FBI could not get into with the hacker and the terrorist in San Bernardino. And then you have data in motion, which are communications, phone calls, text messages that are being sent through the air, which sometimes are called end-to-end encrypted, which law enforcement, if it's end-to-end encrypted, cannot get access to once it's in motion.
And the companies cannot either.
And the companies cannot either because they don't have the key. The only people who have it are the sender and the receiver.
Well, that's not necessarily true. The companies may have the key. Now, if they don't have the key and it's good encryption, then she's right. They can't get into it. But many times they do have the key.
Our policies at Facebook are that we don't allow any violent organization...
Oops, I don't know how it jumped to that. Hold on.
So you have those two different types of encryption, two different types of problems and solutions all get lumped in together as this one big going dark. But I guess I wanted to also ask Dana to sort of describe the extent of the problem and its impact on investigations both in national security cases and in the criminal side, because I think they might be a little different, too.
A little different, but it's somewhat mm-hmm. hard to separate sometimes. We mm-hmm. can kind of go through that a little bit. I don't know Mr. Schneider, but I also don't know if he's ever tried any criminal cases, so I'm not sure that I would agree that it's just kind of something nice to have, like a new set of golf clubs. It's really, there are cases, look, if you're going to have, and there's a need for strong encryption. Nobody argues about that. There's mm-hmm. a need for personal privacy. Nobody's going to argue against that. It just is a matter of how absolute it's going to be. I mean, I don't think it's ever been absolute. It's always been a reasonable expectation of privacy, at least constitutionally. But if you're going to have encryption platforms that no one can get into, there is going to be a cost to that, and I'm not the sky is falling or something like that, but there will be certain cases that you cannot prosecute. In some cases, you'll be able to. We try to work around it. We don't, like, okay, pick up our toys and go home if a cell phone is encrypted. We continue to work. But there will be a certain number of cases that cannot be tried. In society, that's a decision it will make, whether, you know, you're going to have that absolute block of information, of conversations that are... we can't use. We want, you know, there's a lot of protections when we go to get a a conversation. It's not that we just are out there, you know, randomly trolling. We've
roll up your pants leg now.
We're looking at criminals, we think, and we have to, in the case of a search warrant, where the content of communications, the content of, we have to have probable cause. It's even different.
Sure.
By a detached magistrate, we don't get to decide that. And the same thing with our
Does the NSA have to have probable cause?
The three warrants, you know, they're reviewed periodically by a judge to make sure everything's going okay. But I think that to say there's going to be no cost at all would be wrong. And to say that we ought to have access to it, there's always this description of the government wants a back door. Well, no, I don't want a back door that I can just access. I have tremendous confidence in our technology industry. It's by far the best in the world. We invented most everything there is with it. Yeah. To say that we can't have a system where that is secure and that with appropriate judicial oversight, those are provided to the government in a criminal investigation, I just don't accept that narrative.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But you've already heard from somebody who works for a tech company that says if you give that to the government, you are providing, you're actually weakening it for everybody.
Right. I have tremendous confidence in all of the teenagers and hackers out there that if there is a way, if there is a back door, they will find it.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing, and we're almost out of time, unfortunately, but the point is that as long as you have math, you're going to have encryption. And if they are successful at doing away with the apps, the common technology that's being used everywhere, and if they're successful at doing away with that, then they will be able, the criminals are just going to roll their own. They'll roll their own apps. Because it's just like the same thing with the gun control argument. If you ban guns, only the criminals are going to have the guns. If you ban encryption, only the criminals and the terrorists are going to have the encryption. All it's going to do is stop honest people because they will find ways to organize and communicate in a way that's unencrypted. The genie is out of the bottle. There's nothing that these people can do about it, but they're going to keep on because guess what? We're the enemies. We are the ones they consider the terrorists.
Yes. All of these societal defense systems that they're implementing are to defend them from us.
There you go. And with that, we're out of time. Thanks, Vicki.
Thank you, Darren.
It goes by fast. Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. God bless each and every one of you. And tell somebody about the broadcast. Join us back here next week. And we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.